Welcome to Necronomapod.
Necronomapod, it is.
Colon.
The Forbidden Books Group.
Colon. The Lair of the Bookish Worm.
And that's what the title is going to be, I guess, until we change our mind.
It'll always be that title.
It'll always be that title.
I've had it sanctioned by the government.
By the government.
I've written in.
So we're learning quite a bit on how to do this, and
hopefully we'll be a little bit better this time than we were last time.
Hopefully, yeah.
We're drinking cocktails,
indeed.
Back to which
Today's cocktail because it's called the Frisky Witch, and why don't we just do this right away? I'll tell you how to mix the Frisky Witch. It is one part Sambuca. Black Sambuca, and one part vodka. Shake over ice and drink.
And it's delicious.
Delicious. Anyway, which brings us to today's book. It is Conjure Wife by Fritz Leiber. We both just finished it. Well, actually, you finished it some time ago.
It took me 4 hours.
Read it. Probably took me 4 hours, but they weren't consecutive hours.
It was a fun read.
I liked it quite a bit.
Me too.
It was.
I was surprised that I liked it.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Well, bracing for. I don't know. I was bracing for the arcane. You know, that arcane language of the.
Oh,
I don't know, and you do have to, with these older novels, you have to put yourself in this. You have to think differently. You have to think slower.
Okay,
you
sure.
have to, how do I describe this author's, the way he writes is very laborious.
Laborious?
Laborious. Lugubrious?
No!
What
do you mean, like when you say arcane? You mean like 19th century Gothic fiction? Like
yeah, I was
Edgar
bracing.
Poe,
yeah, I was bracing
Wilkie
for
Collins.
I was bracing for that, but there definitely is that. It's not that style. It's not like Edgar Allan Poe or Robert Louis Stevenson, but
no, or H.P. Lovecraft.
Right, but it does have that. There is a different style.
Yes,
that would not fly today. I just don't think it would fly today.
I don't think so. I mean this. This story was originally written for the pulps. It was originally published in 1943, it wasn't published for.
Which you mean it was written in 42 or 41? Mm-hmm. I mean, right during the war,
and probably serialized or published entirely in an old pulp. I think it was Unknown Worlds or something like that. One of the old, highly collectible weird tales type. Pulp magazines, it kind of fits that style. You were expecting arcane language, and it's a little bit more hard nosed than that.
Right.
It's a little bit more forthright.
Right.
Kind of like the other style of pulp writing, the Raymond Chandler, Black Mask pulp magazine. The crime novel style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of halfway between those, I guess.
It kind of is. Yeah.
The other thing that I noticed is that if this had been written today, you could see the movie script. You could see the movie, the shots. You can still see how this could be made into a movie, and in fact has been.
Right. Three times.
But it's still written for somebody turning pages.
Yeah, it's not written. Yeah. It's not as visual as, and he leaves some things where you don't know what is he talking about or purposely vague.
Yeah, he's purposely vague. That's actually that's something I've noticed. Mike here has not read as much Fritz Leiber as I have.
This is my first go.
Yeah, Fritz Leiber. Is a grandmaster of science fiction, fantasy, and horror writing.
Right, he was a contemporary of Lovecraft.
Well,
he was
a correspondent with Lovecraft. He was a contemporary, but he was Lovecraft was you know, sort of an elder, and Fritz Leiber was just a little guy, just a young guy, just starting to write. But they wrote letters back and forth. Anybody wrote Lovecraft or letters, he wrote back, and so it's pretty easy to start a correspondence with Lovecraft. But Fritz Leiber started in the pulps back in the 30s, and wrote some huge classics of the horror genre, of which Condra Wife is one. Also, our next week's book, which will be Our Lady of Darkness, two apparently important books in the genre.
Yeah, and hard to find.
And not that hard to find.
Kind of hard to find.
Well, if you don't want to pay much for them, then but you can find them. He also wrote one of the great series of fantasy, the Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser series, which many Dungeons and Dragons playing teenagers such as myself read when they were Dungeons and Dragons reading playing teenagers. Those are really good. Those are really good stories. Really fun, and kind of define the genre for a lot of people. Also, he wrote big important science fiction novels such as The Big Time, which won I think the Hugo back in the 50s, and a ton of short stories.
Didn't this win something?
I'm not sure that The Condra Wife won anything, but Our Lady of Darkness won the World Fantasy Award in the late 70s. Yeah. And these two books, The Condra Wife and Our Lady of Darkness, are generally available as a double novel. You can buy them together in one volume now.
So Our Lady of Darkness was written in the 70s.
Yeah, written in the 70s. So Fritz Leiber was... the son of Shakespearean actors, apparently
a well-known drunk, from what I hear.
Not well-known, although he did go on a couple-year bender after his first wife died. Mm-hmm. He's very well respected. He passed away in the early 90s, and I remember that.
Didn't he write for Night Gallery or something, from what I read, or some TV things he wrote for?
Possibly, yeah. I'm not sure about that. I know he wrote a Tarzan novel. Pretty cool. He wasn't the most prolific writer, most of what he wrote is in print still. And he had a very long career. So, and his son, Justin Leiber, is also a science fiction writer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's still working. So to this book.
This book.
What did you think? You like this book. This is a fun read.
I liked it. It took me probably about 30 pages to get into it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Me too. It's
that's the funny thing about doing this thing is it gives this uber sort of commitment that makes me have to drive through things that I normally would say throw down after like 10 pages and say I'm not wasting my time.
Back to the library with you.
So yes. So that's a challenge.
Yeah.
That I'm gladly picking up.
Sure, sure.
Because I get to experience things I probably normally wouldn't. Yeah,
and this one was worth it.
I think it was worth it.
Yeah,
it was...
I think this was totally worth it. It took me a little while. Fritz Leiber, I think, writes, he plays his cards carefully. He's got his plot in mind, and he lays out things carefully. He sets things up for later in the novel.
Well, yeah, and the other thing about him, and I think I noticed it more... It's going to be hard not to talk about the other novel and talk about, because you haven't finished Our Lady of Darkness.
I haven't finished it. I haven't started it.
That probably less so in this one, but he tends to tell and not show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's long, not so much in this one, mm-hmm. but there are these long explanations,
expositions, and lectures,
and mini lecture series that, and so the action. He's not. There isn't a lot of action.
No, there's
probably. I know you didn't want to do it this way, but there's more action probably in Conjure Wife than there is in The Lady Darkness.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, The Conjure Wife doesn't have a lot of action. It has a couple of set pieces.
Yes, it's like a parlor, an old parlor drama.
Yeah, Drammer. It kind of is. And there's some exciting bits, there's some interesting turns, surprises.
There's some creepiness.
There's some real creepiness. The witchcraft stuff isn't particularly scary. I don't think any of the witches themselves are really scary.
They're scary as far as their mundaneness. I think this Conjure Wife,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking the guy who wrote Rosemary's Baby must have read this book, because
probably IR 11.
IR 11. It's mm-hmm. that mundane, that there's underneath the surface of the ordinary is yeah. all this evil. Yeah. Probably David Lynch must have read this.
He might have.
You know, so these ordinary things are, and even these ordinary people, you know, you could see some of these women on Mayberry RFD or something.
Well, I know. I mean,
but
Mayberry RFD.
Their actions are wicked, you know?
Yeah. They're self-serving.
Well, there's wickedness in this book because they wanted to take this woman's soul.
Well, yeah.
And they were plotting, they had these weak husbands that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I do, the witchcraft in a way was, let's put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I can compare it to. I think this explanation or show of witchcraft is much more to really how it is, as opposed to what you see on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because it's much more,
or Bewitched. Probably
even Bewitched, because it's very ordinary. It's very not showy, you know?
Yeah, and it's
using playing cards or tying knots or things that, you know, if you're not paying attention, you don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
But when you're paying attention...
It's the witchcraft is basically, it looks exactly like superstition. It's exactly like
superstition. Which can look exactly like nothing. It could look like knitting.
Yeah, it could look like knitting, yeah. I thought, that was one aspect that I liked quite a bit about the book was the ordinariness of the witchcraft, you know.
That's what made it very much more believable to me.
Yeah, I mean,
it's as far as you can
believe this fantasy novel.
Right.
And the witches, I mean, the reason that the witches weren't particularly scary to me is that they were first introduced as just, you know, faculty wives.
That's why they were scary to me, because they were faculty wives in the plotting and scheming and the shunning.
Oh, the shunning. Did you? Let's talk a little bit about the academic.
Wait, can we go? Before we do that, what I was going to talk about was, what I wanted to say was that I lived with a Hmong family for a summer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had sort of this shamanic ritual thing at the end of my time with them while I was living on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you blinked, you wouldn't have known that anything had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because things were just so not... there weren't big parentheses around things. You know, you just sort of did stuff. You didn't make a big show of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did a little thing here, a little thing there. And you wouldn't even have thought anything had really happened. But, you know, later on, you figured, oh, there was a ritual. I was just involved in a ritual.
You just followed the ritual.
And didn't really know that I was, because it was very just sort of passé.
Yeah.
I think is how native sort of religions,
mm-hmm.
that's how it is.
It's a way of doing things.
It's just a way of doing things. Yeah. And there's not a big hoo-ha like the... I'm thinking of witchcraft in The Gardnerian or Alistair, the witch movement, the Golden Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
Alistair Crowley.
Alistair Crowley.
It was very ritual.
Yeah. The theosophist.
Yeah, and it was this very showy, sort of almost Catholic.
Catholic witchcraft.
Witchcraft. And which is much more theatrical.
Yeah.
And this stuff is much more how it really is.
Yeah. Let's talk about that then. The protagonist, the one of the protagonists, Norman Sailor,
Norman and his wife Tansy.
Tansy. Tansy.
An unfortunate name.
Well, it's short for Constanza.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
Oh.
Tansy is would be I'm guessing would be short for Constanza, which is Constancy.
Very good.
She's very she's a very constant wife.
She is a constant
She
wife.
takes care of her husband.
She's a very good 1940s wife.
Yes. Who, how did he meet her? She was his student. And
Yes. And it
it
was okay.
was okay as long as you didn't get caught too often by the faculty wives.
The name of the college is Hemp.
Hempnall.
Hempnall.
Hempnall. But Norman Sailor is a professor of was it sociology?
Yeah,
Sociology, but
sociology.
specifically I think like anthropology and psychology. He writes on
Superstition
superstition.
and
He writes on folklore, folkloric
he wrote
superstition.
something in voodoo, I think,
And Tansy followed him around, and this is apparently where she.
and he went to the South and met
Went
up
to the
with
South.
some Negroes.
Yes. I wonder if there's a real famous black ethnographer and folklore collector is now known mostly as a novelist, but it was Zora Neale Hurston
Oh yeah.
who
She had a
went.
famous voodoo novel,
And she,
which names is the name escapes me.
it wasn't. It's not
Not Their Eyes Were Watching.
Of Mules and Men.
No.
We can't think of it, but I'm sure some of you
Somebody
can.
will.
And this is the kind of magic that this is where Tansy learned her
It's
magic. It's conjuring.
conjuring
It's
magic.
conjuring.
It's the stuff you read in Huck Finn.
It's swinging a cat
burying
at a
frog,
barren
burying
thing.
rubbing a stone on a frog and then rubbing the stone on your wart and then burying the wart in the
Burying the
moonlight
wart in
and
the
then
moonlight and getting stuff out of a graveyard, some great graveyard dirt and things like
nail
that.
clippings and feathers and
Feathers and cat gut, stuff like
yeah, it
that.
was cat.
Gut she gets from a tennis
But
racket.
she had a, but she also had a familiar.
She did.
And I don't know if the other witches
They
did.
never really make that
And that's the other
explicit.
thing. They don't, yeah, they don't. But
What's
you
a
know.
familiar? A familiar is an animal that sort of assists and is there with a
Right,
witch.
it's almost like a power channel or something.
And it's is it Totem? Totem the cat?
Totem the
I
cat.
wonder if there's a tab.
Totem the
I
cat. The wonderful, wonderful
wonder if there
cat.
was a taboo cat too. Totem and taboo. Anyway.
Totem and Tina's wedding. And the cat
And the
dies.
cat dies. Yeah,
Well, the cat
it's
doesn't die, the cat is
the cat is murdered by
murdered.
an animated concrete dragon sculpture.
Yeah, which was very that well, I don't know if we want to talk about that yet, but that was the one that was the thing that was weakly drawn for me,
See,
but
that was a very Fritz Leiber moment.
vague and something's going on and
But what the way he presents it in the book is very psychological. He talks about subliminal, like noticing things. It's how we notice the world around us. Has that dragon always been there on the roof?
Right.
That little sculptural thing, has was it always been right there, or is it it's a little lower now? But I'm not sure.
Right.
And that's just part of the constant psychologizing that goes on in this book. Other psychologizing that goes on is that whole business about being of two minds, being of logical mind and of sort of splitting
Of
your
the id,
consciousness.
yeah.
There's all kinds. I mean, in this book, I saw definitely Carl Jung
Definitely.
about the archetypes of the anima and animus, the female and
I think
male.
some gestalt.
There's a little
Well, he
bit of.
wouldn't have been, would Fritz Perls have been around then?
I don't know, but
Yeah, probably, possibly some
but
gestalt.
early behaviorism is in there.
Sure, why
Before
not?
B.F. Skinner, was it Watson? James Watson, I think, which is a way to explain why people do things without referring to consciousness whatsoever. And that's how he explains why Tansy, when she has her soul removed, is still able to walk around and speak, and because she has no. She's not there anymore, but she can still move around because she's getting stimuli and can
From her, reptilian brain or something.
Yeah, or just the wiring. The wiring's still
But it
there.
still sort of makes her available to some uber consciousness or something that
I know. Oh,
knows things and understands things. And
it's very problematic.
is problematic, and that's one of those. That's one of those. That's one of those moments where he's telling you. That's where you get many lectures.
Yes.
Well, because Tansy's soul gets taken away, but Tansy is still kind of like plugged in.
Yes.
To like this arcane knowledge, this Gnostic experience, and now she understands all these things. It would be the if that was made today, that version would be going into the internet. It would be the same. She was like in the internet.
Yeah,
she was in the wireless.
Mm-hmm. Wireless.
Transmitting all this lane. Transmitting all this.
And the wired.
The wired.
Yeah.
Transmitting the wired. All this information that, you know, all of a sudden it's like all easily laid out.
Mm-hmm.
For the protagonist,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
which is you know kind of cheap and dirty, and
one of my favorite parts where unlikely plot developments was the ability to use abstract symbolic logic.
I know, it just came out of nowhere.
No.
And using the witch's husband to help them do that. Was that what you're talking about?
Yeah, at the very end there,
when he goes in. With these symbols and
does a logical reduction or whatever, some factors.
Boom, 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 boom. The solution is there. And
let three pieces of cat gut equal X. Let graveyard dirt equal Y.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. That was one of the things
that was fairly ridiculous.
It was. But. Yeah. There was points. See, I don't think you could get away with that today.
No. No, I don't.
Maybe in a bad movie or something.
Yeah. But at the time that this was written, this is I mean, now today to do that, they would have to use some sort of super advanced artificial intelligence program or something like that. You know, using current science. But this book in 1943 is using extremely current science.
Yes.
Back then. Right. Jungian Freudian psychology, behaviorism was all hard edge science.
It was all the rage.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm thinking I'm just going to mention Buffy every time we do this.
I think you should.
But they talk about when they were writing their scripts that there would be that, I forget the term that they use, but there would always be that some sort of device, a book that they would go to or something that would have this all this ephemera that would be very necessary in order to make things happen. It was a plot device. It was a thing they used. It was sort of like Deus Ex Machina of the to get the story going.
Yes.
And so this is what this guy does.
Yeah.
A lot.
A lot.
And lots of different versions.
Yep.
Whether it's the soulless wife who now is like plugged into the universe.
Yep. Yep.
Or
the this guy's ability to use. Abstract logical symbolic logic,
right. Which
to decipher
basically saves the day.
Saves the day, yeah.
And also is the. I mean, if we're gonna go into like patriarchy, it's sort of
we're gonna have to sooner or later.
It's sort of the, you know, the males usurping the domain of the woman,
yes,
and using now making it okay,
yeah.
Right?
Making it okay.
Because,
well, it's kind of interesting.
They're using, you know, algorithms of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, yeah. Logical expression. They're using just
symbolic
logic,
language.
Like, yeah. Was it Bertrand Russell's symbolic logic?
Yes.
Let X. I mean. Anyway.
Well, it's logic.
It's
logic. X equals Y, therefore Z.
Yeah.
Or
if this, then that. Yes.
Yeah.
Good heavens, I forgot what I was going to say. Something about... blah, blah, blah. We're going to be cutting this part out. I'll think of it in a second because it was highly apropos.
Here, I'll clink the cocktail so you remember. There won't be a lot of vamping.
We were talking...
By vamping, we mean vampire.
We were talking about science
And oh,
the male usurping the,
I remember the male usurping the female, the
feminine,
the feminine. Yeah. Yeah. So there's obviously in this book there's a there's a lot of monkeying around about gender roles. What is what is masculine? What is feminine? The feminine right. world. And this is, you know, this is, comes from probably Fritz Leiber's interest in, or it's as at least reinforced by Fritz Leiber's interest in Jungian psychology. But the realm of magic,
perhaps
the realm of magic, the realm of illogic,
is the domain of women.
Is the domain of women,
and that in this book, all women have this knowledge. Yeah.
Now, before I read this book, just looking at the back cover and, you know, just reading about the book, I thought that that there was this worldwide conspiracy, and it's not. The women simply pick this up because of their femaleness. Apparently, they learn it from their mothers. They learn it from, and it's a trial and error. It is still, it's kind of scientific because they try things. And if it works, they do it that way, and they monkey with it, and they try different variations.
Well,
and it's
that's
by scientific method,
I mean,
more or less.
All right. Yes, exactly. Well, think about, she has a diary. Her diary is her grimoire.
Yeah.
And that's what a grimoire is.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what the alchemist did.
Mm-hmm.
You try this, you try that, you try this. What? And it's very practical.
Yes.
And in a way, it's very scientific.
It is. Well, and he
but
makes
it's
that
working
point,
on a different.
And he makes that point explicitly in there because he says that men can be witches. There are still warlocks, but for the most part, masculinity has left us behind because of the Enlightenment, because of science, because of the split.
That's so interesting. That's put into the realm of men, isn't it? The Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment. Yes.
It's in the realm of men.
Yeah. But there's a breaking point. It was in alchemy, because alchemy was this original kind of trial and error science ish practice. And
it was the science of the time. I mean, it was the prototype of science.
Or it was, you know,
the precursor.
Precursor of science, yeah. And from
as if science wasn't ever happening. I mean, you know,
I mean, it's
hypothesis and observation.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. This wasn't
forever.
It hadn't been laid out into a logical methodology. But the in this book, this is supposed to be apparently separated, and it's separated by sex, by gender. What our hero Norman learns is to bring up that feminine part of himself, and it's really explicit. It's, you know, his brain is split when he's doing this. He's like, all right, I'm just going to put away all of my logic for a little while. I'm just going
to
let it go to sleep.
Yes,
it's still there.
Yeah.
He's just like, I'm going to pretend as if magic works.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go forward on that.
Even though.
Very scientifically.
Which is funny. Even though everything in the book is showing him through his own eyes and experience that this is happening.
Yes.
This is actually happening.
That's
at least
that kind of protagonist that usually, and sometimes it's a narrator, is really an archetype of weird fiction, and it goes back at least as far as H.P. Lovecraft's narrators, who are seeing crazy things happening right in front of them, and the evidence keeps piling up and piling up and piling up. And this bothers people.
Or the Scullies,
or the Scullies, or Scully, of course, from X-Files.
These are the Scullies.
Yeah, and these people are doubters. I'm a doubter. I'm one of those people.
I suppose that you can even go back to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mean, I think it took him a while to sort of embrace that.
But what happens is, and this is the thing that drives some people crazy about Lovecraft's fiction, and I'm sure it drives some people crazy about Norman in this book, is that, you know, the evidence is right in front of you. I mean, you can't miss it. But they're too logical. They don't believe it. It has to literally come up and bite them, and then write and tell them why they're biting them in the butt.
But you know, if you think about it, that's the whole argument. You know, the skeptics of things that are seem supernatural is that it's just, you know, a weird sort of amalgam of coincidence.
Yeah.
That can be explained, that eventually can be explained.
Exactly.
At this point, you know, this, the protagonist, it doesn't have an explanation other than what he's just going to go with what's been given to him.
Yeah.
At some point, he just is going to go with it.
Yeah.
And he holds it loosely, even though,
yeah,
in the end, you know, even the wife sort of questions, well, did he really believe that this was this, or did he just believe that there was these three, this sort of,
yeah, these three,
this folio do kind of thing going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, folio d'accord. Yeah, the four women. Yeah, he's like, I'm going to pretend, I'm going to say these, they're all going crazy.
Right.
But they're crazy the same way, and their craziness is affecting each other.
Right.
So when this one casts a completely ineffectual spell on my wife, my wife believes it's that it works, and so she behaves in a certain way.
Right.
And so he needs to go in and, you know, play their game and then beat them at it.
Right.
Disbelieving it the whole time.
Right.
Sort of. At the end, he kind of comes
right.
back. Realizes
right
that maybe there is something to
well it kind of goes to that idea of what's real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on what in what world really you you're it's depending on what planet you're standing on.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are real, and then
yep.
you switch and
yep.
it, some things are not real.
Yep.
And the same thing, the exact same thing.
Yep. I think yeah that's
all, you know, to the what is it, to the victor goes the spoils.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, the winners write the history.
Yeah,
the I mean that's the part of the book that I most enjoyed was that whole playing with belief and doubt
mm-hmm.
and logic and illogic, and
very broadly drawn, not a lot of subtlety.
No, not a lot of
falls along traditional lines. Yeah. Of...
Well, traditional lines now, but I mean. He's doing a science fictional sort of thing. He's trying to find logical reasons for magic. I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah.
It made for a fun.
It was a
fun romp.
It was a smashing read. Smashing.
I do think it gives a more insight into Fritz's. Idealizing of women.
His
and it really shows up in the other novel as well.
Which we'll talk about.
But he, you know, that these women hold these secrets and these
mm-hmm.
women hold this sort of power and these women,
yeah.
and that women have.
Yeah. To a teenage boy.
And in a way, women sort of
that's
hold,
exactly what it seems like.
Women end up being... I mean, talk about the woman behind the man.
Mm-hmm.
Behind every successful man is this woman. It's definitely this. The woman is the matrix and the...
Yeah.
The mater.
Yeah. The matrix,
that's where the matrix comes from, right? So
matrix is...
Is mater.
Well, specifically the womb.
Yeah, so this is definitely women. Women are... And so in a way, it's one of those funny things because he takes with one hand and gives with the other, which is always what happens when you idealize somebody.
Yes,
you know, and
yes,
you know, and they're lovingly regarded and then smashed to bits
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, they're set on a pedestal and made to stand there for punishment.
Right, and that comes through in his writing so.
Pretty clearly.
It is not his kind of his not having an understanding of women.
No.
And
no.
He really seeing them as the, you know, pick a little, talk a little.
Yeah.
But
at the same time.
Having an understanding of
women. He's trying to break down those barriers. I mean, that's what, and on
yeah,
one level, that's what this book is about breaking down the barriers between the masculine and the feminine as he sees it.
Yes,
but what
as
he's,
he
but,
sees
what he's
it.
But by doing it, he's actually kind of building the barriers. Reinforcing.
It's sort of like Uncle Tom's Cabin of Witchcraft, or
yeah, that's right.
He's definitely a man of his time, but in a way, mm-hmm. not of his time.
Yeah, well, he's. I mean,
he's raising questions.
Yeah, he's raising questions. One of the ways he's maybe not ahead of his time, but he's surfing the wave of his time is
yeah.
all this free love business.
Oh yeah,
which is really charming.
Yeah, what is the free love? What are you talking about? With the
well, free love. Well, he keeps talking. Well, one of the things that he's lectures about is about sexual outlet.
Because you know, the free love movement started in the 1920s.
Oh yes, of course it did. Or even before that. And just you know, it's just battering at the walls of Victorianism. And you know, they're crumbling pretty handily by the 1943.
Yeah.
But not so much.
I don't
much
know
so,
if in Connecticut they were
yeah,
crumbling.
Yeah, but, and not so much so that you can stand in front of a college freshman social class and lecture
and
about
say penis.
Well, no. But you can't talk about sexual outlets outside of the bounds of marriage, which he does. And he's, you know, because his wife had been protecting him earlier,
he could get away with it,
but right. when he makes her destroy all of her little mojo and her little totems, he can't, and he gets into trouble, which is not surprising, especially in a highly political environment like a college campus, so and he talks about you know, sneaking off with his young wife, you know, those scenes, and he scandalizes was it Gracie Pollard? Is that her name? The college dean's daughter.
Yes.
So there's that going on through there as well, which I think is very
a little wish fulfillment.
A little wish fulfillment. Well, I think I'm not positive, but I think Fritz Leiber was living in San Francisco much of this time, and you know, we love capital.
I don't think he was there the whole time. I think he eventually moved there.
Oh, you could be right. You could be right. Yeah.
Well, you live, you know, you've been, you were sort of in academia.
I was, yes. I sort of still.
You still, sort of.
Sorry, sort of, am I?
I had a friend who was a professor at a small, well, he's at a large university now in Chicago, but he was at a small college in Iowa and then a small college in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And his stories to me of that life, that academic life, and all I can think of when I'm reading this book is all I can think of is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at the same time, which is very odd because
I had
Tansy as a young Elizabeth Taylor.
And, all those drinking scenes and them getting loaded.
That's sort of that everything is being watched and scrutinized and measured against something else.
Yes.
And people vying in the pecking order,
and the
jungle of the academic world.
It's absolutely right. I mean, this is in one way, this is a pretty good college novel.
It's a great analogy, don't you think?
I'm thinking of like a recent college novel, like Jane Smiley's Moo.
Yeah, which I think I read, but don't remember.
Yeah, it's just about college politics and stuff like that.
Or Wonder Boy.
Wonder Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's another one. But that stuff is serious. I'm thinking of a recent example where a professor who was living a charmed life suddenly had all of his totems erased. Specifically, it was a Native American studies professor at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Is this true?
This is true. His name is Ward Churchill.
Uh-huh.
He writes. He wrote some pretty devastating things about 9/11, saying that, you know, basically the United States deserved 9/11, which is a highly unpopular thing to
say. Depends what you mean by deserve.
Well, yeah, exactly. But he identifies as Native American, and somebody checked that out.
Checked out if he was Native American.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And
he wasn't.
And he's not.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is particularly bad because he one of his main arguments that he kind of made his career on is arguing that Native American the status of being Native American is based on a racist ideas of blood quantum defined by white men.
Right, you have to be like an eighth or a quarter.
Yeah, an eighth or something.
Well, it's the whole
like
thing about black. If you have like a drop of black in you, you're black.
Yeah, exactly. Which is very
the African of
So he's saying that this is a white this is, you know, imposed by whites and has been adopted by Native American communities. Well, it turns out to be kind of, and so what he argues is that that if somebody identifies him or herself as Native American, then you are. Which is,
this is very
in the end, very self-serving. So anyway, this all came out about a year ago, and it has almost, you know, he's, you know, fully tenured professor, and it almost lost him his job. I'm not exactly sure what his
final situation is. Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude in college and academic life.
Oh my God, yes.
Because I'm sure there were just people just rubbing their hands with glee as they watched indeed. The demise.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Oh man. So yeah, so poor Ward Churchill. Somebody burned all of his little totems. Anyway.
Well, it's interesting because I've been reading... if by reading I mean listening to on tape.
God bless the book on disc.
This book called The Secret, which mm-hmm. is a it's not a novel. It's like what the bleep do we know? Did you ever?
Oh yeah,
right.
I never saw it, but yeah.
Well, it's talking about that there's a fundamental law. There's a law in the universe of gravity, and there's mm-hmm. a law in the universe of attraction, mm-hmm. and that our mind. We have the power to attract things to our life, and mm-hmm. we actually, what our life is because we've attracted it to us through our thoughts, which I agree, I believe.
Sure.
So, where was I going with this? Booze is kicking in.
Oh, that frisky witch. She's cast a spell on you.
Oh, it's the idea. So the idea in this is that when you begin to doubt, mm-hmm. and if you do not catch your doubt, that doubt will attract more doubt, and doubt will attract the occurrences, the events of doubt that will, mm-hmm. you know, feed more doubt.
Yes.
And so this is exactly what happens. There is a law of attraction in this book, mm-hmm. and the character experiences a twinge of, am I fucked?
Yeah.
And then it just cascades into, you know, so you could think it's the wife throwing things, her totems away. I don't know if they're called totems, but whatever, her charms away that make this happen. But perhaps it's him.
Oh, it's absolutely him.
It's his doubt of himself and his wife and all that stuff that begins to attract trouble.
Yes.
The trouble is his. Yes. His trouble is his. He creates the trouble.
Oh, it's absolutely
by making her throw things away.
Yeah.
And his own sort of...
And she's
of,
smart enough to... She plays his game, and she gets rid of everything, but she knows damn well...
There's that one little thing in the watch. That he gets rid of. And that's when everything turns.
Everything turns right
so
then.
So he begins the trouble with his own sort of arrogance.
Yep.
And he has to fix the trouble.
And he does. Yeah.
But it's all his.
It
is all his.
He brings it on himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is quite delightful.
It was quite delightful.
But he doesn't the thing is, and the character doesn't really recognize that he's caused the trouble.
No. See, that's what I was going to say. Does he ever figure out all the poo he smeared in, he picked it up and smeared it all over
which
himself.
Which is pure projection. It's pure, if you want to go with the Jungian thing, it's pure, throw your poo on everybody else.
Yeah.
But it's really yours, buddy.
It's really his.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything was going just
that's why he's the fine. Protagonist and not her.
Yeah.
Because it would be interesting to go from her, take the story from her point of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
And later novels, I'm sure. I don't think I've ever read any other witch novels.
The Witching Hour.
Yeah. Anne Rice has some.
Yeah. Which is really good up until the last 10 pages.
Ooh.
Because then you're like screwed. The reader gets screwed for a sequel.
Ooh.
And the sequel sucks.
That is all we're going to talk about Anne Rice.
The end.
The end.
No, and barley and oats.
And oats and millet.
And
quinoa.
Spelt.
And quinoa.
And kamut.
Oh, what else do we have to say about this book? What's on our little list here?
Let's pause for just a second. Gets all of this information from... She, her initial information comes from meeting with the Negroes.
Yes, following and helping Norman's studies.
Right, and then she eventually sort of creates her own trial and error sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that the power or whatever you want to call it, the information, the knowledge comes from, you know, the dark race.
Yes.
And the superstitious.
Yes. The ones
being studied.
Specifically the unenlightened.
Right.
Yeah.
That, yes.
And anyway, it started, you know, back before Europeans were enlightened. That's where, you know,
right,
that Europeans had these powers. Right. But now it resides more or less in, what do we see in here? We see a maid, Tansy, like.
Yes.
And the voodoo practitioners that Norman studies.
Is a man.
Was he a man?
Yeah.
Really? Interesting.
Yes.
Very nice.
Kind of a witch doctor sort of
thing. Oh, right. Yeah, the witch doctors.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting is that in the white world, you know, the men don't possess this knowledge.
Yep.
But in, you know, the lesser races,
yeah,
they're, you know, put on par with the female. So
yes,
you can see this hierarchy.
Yeah.
Which I don't think Fritz believes. I think he's poking fun at that.
Well, he is poking fun at it, but he also believes it, because he's talking about, I mean, at the same time that he's trying to batter down Victorian sex prohibition, or at least Norman is. We should be careful about whether, you know, we're talking about
Fritz
saying or Norman saying.
I mean, if you have to stand back from the novel, then you'd have to say it was Fritz.
Yeah.
That Fritz is poking fun at things. He's poking fun at the character of Norman and his rigidness. And lack of imagination.
He's definitely doing that. And so Norman gets undercut severely.
Yes. But I mean, the one who comes out smelling like a rose is Tansy.
Yeah. Yeah, Tansy. Sweet Tansy, who's young and vivacious and very sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a witchy woman.
I'm thinking she's wearing a sweater set and has pointy boobs.
She probably has, pointy boobs.
And probably blonde.
Really? I saw brown hair.
Really?
Really, I saw brown
really?
Hair.
Really? I saw blonde.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
And pearls.
Pearls. Definitely pearls.
I definitely saw pearls. Well,
what about the other one? So, okay, we have Tansy, who's...
I definitely was thinking of Mayberry RFD, all those women like Aunt B and Aunt B's friend, the tall one with the big nose. I mean...
You have more, obviously, more experience with Mayberry RFD than I do.
Or I'm thinking Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah.
But a lot of those people were in Rosemary's Baby. Those same women... We're in Rosemary's Baby.
I mean, the actual actresses or the archetypes?
Yes, the actual actresses.
That is fantastic. Yeah,
Clara and Andy Griffith, who's Aunt Bee's bitchy friend, is in Rosemary's Baby, and she's one of the evil witches.
See, I haven't seen... I've seen Rosemary's Baby, but it has been some
time. We'll have to rent it, because...
We'll have to check that one out.
You can see
and
where...
So should you, because it is...
One of my favorite movies.
Yeah, it is one of the best horror movies ever made. It's kind of funny, as long as we're going to be veering wildly off the subject here.
We're talking about witches and
witchy women. We're talking
about
witches and witch women, of course. I can't remember, I was watching something about Roman Polanski, and he was talking about making Rosemary's Baby, which is a huge success for him. I mean, he had big successes before that. But it was the first time he'd ever adapted a script. Everything else he had done before that was his own story.
His early stuff was weird.
It's very weird. Like, Knife in the Water is very strange. Ugh. And The Tenant.
The Tenant is so weird.
That's a really good movie, though. Yeah. David Lynch learned a lot from The Tenant.
Mm-hmm. If I learned, you mean stole.
Yeah. If I learned, you mean stole. But Rosemary's Baby, he had no idea how to, like, adapt a novel into a screenplay. So he just copied it. He just... Scene for scene.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Pretty much.
Which is why I've never read the book, because I think, I've seen it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And also, R11 He wrote a sequel to Rosemary's Baby called Son of Rosemary.
Oh dear.
Pure shit on crackers.
Shit on crackers. It was a little so, with a tiny spoonful.
Oh
of
my god, caviar. It was so out of control.
Oh,
it was
dear.
The worst thing I've ever.
Yeah. Ira Levin has written some of the like the big classics.
What else did he write?
He wrote The Stepford Wives.
Oh yeah.
He wrote
which was I don't know, I never read the book.
Called not gonna think of it.
We haven't done very good.
All y'all can just Google this up. For
I do remember Burn Witch Burn being on the television, broadcast TV when I was a kid.
Do you think? Okay, so now my guess was before I read this book, and I, you know, having gone to graduate school in English, I learned to say a lot of things about books authoritatively by simply looking at their back cover. So before this book, I read this book. I thought that I said that this book, you know, may have been an inspiration for Bewitched. You think?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
And I've always had in my mind that they should redo Bewitched, but call it Dark Bewitched.
Dark Bewitched.
And then and play it serious.
Sure.
Play it straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which would be kind of creepy and weird and
sort of the way that they remade Battlestar Galactica. See, because we have to talk about Battlestar Galactica in every one of our little podcasts.
Yeah, don't play it as comedy. Play it as drama.
Yeah, pure dark,
which would be really
political drama.
To find out your wife is a card carrying witch.
A card carrying witch. Yeah,
a card carrying broom toting cape wearing.
That's
tilting witch.
That's kind of the way that that Buffy would roll once in a while. With you know, people coming out as witches and you know having that be like sort of
well,
a dark
which in a way in
for.
Buffy actually, I mean, I think I misspoke. Really, the way they portrayed witchcraft in Buffy was also very nonchalant for the most part. Especially as Willow got more powerful, all she would do is say it like she just say a word. It wasn't even a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, she didn't
or nothing. Just move her hand.
Yeah, which I appreciate much more.
But. Yeah, we're big Buffy fans.
Yes.
I'm a pretty big Buffy fan, but the other Mike, huge Buffy fan.
Even though I backed off from it a little bit.
Well, yeah, because you know.
Because you know, it's not around.
Yeah, because you want to.
It's a dark, dark thing you can get into.
Because it hurt you.
It hurt
you.
It can hurt.
It hurt you.
It hurt me.
When it stopped.
But all good
hurt.
Things must come to an end, right?
Yeah. No. Yes.
It needed to end. It needed to end.
It needed to end. I will agree with that. Speaking of ending, do we need to end?
Well, was there anything else about... so there's nothing in this book you wish would have happened?
I can sit here and bang my head against the table thinking of something, but I was very satisfied with this book.
What was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was, and you know, God bless Fritz Leiber, was the last scene. I thought that it came to a smashing end. I thought that was fantastic.
What did
was,
you like about it?
I didn't. I guess I didn't see it coming as much as I thought I would.
I totally saw it coming.
You are such a smart man.
I knew exactly.
But
I'm like,
well, maybe
they switch bodies and blah 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 blah.
No. I did see that coming.
I totally saw
but,
it.
But
coming.
before that, you know, chasing her soul around.
Uh-huh.
Where find the soul.
Where in the world is Tansy's soul?
Where in the world is Tansy's soul? Maybe I did see it coming, but I was enjoying the deception enough that I didn't want to try to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
And so I just went with it, and it was very satisfying.
I had a few favorite scenes. I really liked the scene where there's a thunderstorm, and Tansy's desperately tying that knot.
Yes.
And
that was really good.
And she's not saying anything.
Yeah.
She's just doing this little home crafty thing.
Yeah.
And he's kind of got the sense that this thing is saving his ass.
Yeah. I thought that was good
Which,
writing.
That
also,
was a good, yes.
The bridge game was also really
that
good.
I was going to say that was my other favorite
bridge.
Piece. Is there she is, the bad woman, doing these, drawing
all of
these
them.
Little things.
Yeah, all of them. The whole cast
paper.
Is right. Did you find this in any respect Shakespearean?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Macbeth.
Yeah, I'm thinking Macbeth as well. You know, I'm thinking Macbeth.
I'm thinking Macbeth, except Yeah, Macbeth.
I mean, I think.
Except,
I mean, it's,
they're not
the. It freaking screams Macbeth.
They're better people.
Yeah.
Than the Macbeths. Yeah.
But in this version of Macbeth, in Macbeth you have the witches, and you also have Lady Macbeth. But in this one, the witches and Lady Macbeth. I mean, Lady Macbeth is a witch, and she's not evil, but other Macbeths, the other professors that you know are have their
we'll
own.
All have a little bit Macbeth.
They all have a little bit of Lady Macbeth working behind them, and some of them are good Lady Macbeths, and some of them are bad Lady Macbeths. I thought that was pretty fantastic. I thought that was really well done, really well turned.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
And I did like how. You know, in the end, the Tansy, whoever Tansy is at that point, is tied up, and there's this spider,
mm-hmm.
and the spider has the soul of the dog.
The soul of the dog.
Which I had to go back and read it like 5 times. Like, where do they talk about the dog? I don't remember the dog.
Yeah, the dog shows up at some point early on, and that is actually another familiar.
Right, they all had familiars.
And I can't remember which, that would have been Evelyn Sautel's.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar. I can't remember who Mrs. Carr's familiar was.
I don't remember, but I know there was one.
Yep, yep. It was nicely done. It was I think if I were to go back and reread this, and I may not soon, but eventually, I think it would hold up. I think it would be better.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think it was carefully written.
I think it's hard, though, to go back and read these older books because it was like last night when we watched
It Happened One Night.
Mm-hmm. Right?
We watched It Happened One Night
last night. We did watch it. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, fine movie.
But you have to sort of suspend everything you know, in a way, mm-hmm. and think of this as the first time this has happened. Right?
Yes.
In a way, but you can't.
Well,
but
yeah.
You can see where everything sort of comes from.
Yeah, it's a little.
But now we're taking it after the fact and going, oh, well.
Yeah, it's
you
a
know,
little.
That old thing, but that's exactly where that thing came from.
It's a little easier to, for instance, if this book had been written in the 70s, some of its broader caricatures of, sexist caricatures, racist caricatures, would be harder to forgive.
Right,
but because it was in the 40s,
the further back you go,
but there's this, and if it would come out today, it'd be like, oh man, there's no way. If it was set today, if it was set in the 40s, then yeah. But even then, the author would have to like sort of wink at you to let you know that yeah, these are the characters. This is how they think. I'm being historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read things written in the 70s, I'm looking forward to. Going back and reading something that was written in the late 90s in the future and realizing, oh, how could we have thought that back then?
So
I remember thinking that way. I was so naive.
What do you think this book was saying about the times? Because if you think about it, if it was written in 40, if it was published in 43, written in 41, 42, something like that.
The war is going on,
but there's no mention of wars.
None whatsoever.
No. So what do you think? What do you think this book was saying? Was this book saying anything about the times?
No,
other than
this
little universe.
This book was written for a pulp magazine, a fantasy and science fiction and weird fiction pulp magazine. It was escapism.
Mm-hmm.
People had plenty of the war
mm-hmm.
Everywhere else. So I think he just war people.
He wasn't in the war.
I don't think so. No.
Well, why not? Because he was a booze hound, or.
I don't know. Honestly, I don't think he fought.
Hmm.
Maybe he had young kids at home. That didn't make any difference back then, though. Yeah, I wonder what his deferral was.
Yeah, why? Was he crazy? Did he have like 3 extra limbs or what?
Could have been.
Could have been.
Could have been. But I'm really glad I finally read this. I remember hearing about this book when I was a little kid.
Really?
Yeah. This was mentioned. It was reprinted, I think, in a 70s pulp magazine.
that I had. I didn't have the whole book. I had part of it. It was being serialized in it. I had one issue of this magazine. It was called The Haunt of Horror. And I think it was put out by Marvel Comics.
Okay, so is there anything else?
No, I think we're done.
Well, let's put a stake in this puppy.